Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Over 100,000 Americans have officially died of coronavirus complications. Researchers believe that number could be higher. APM research labs show that the number of COVID-19-related fatalities among Black Americans is 2.4 times higher than that of white Americans. The same research shows the number of Latino fatalities is slightly greater than that of whites. Dr. Rogelio Sainz decided to investigate if the Latino statistics are somehow skewed. Sainz is a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Sainz says Latinos are becoming infected and dying of COVID-19 complications at higher rates than officially reported. He joins us today to discuss how he arrived at the data.
The way I started off the research project here is that we were hearing a lot of information regarding the high prevalence rates among African Americans, and there was much speculation. The same thing was going on with the Latino population, but there tended to be very, very little data. So I started putting together and compiling. Every week or so, I would go into the state COVID-19 data portals and pull out data for the Latino population as well as for whites and African Americans. So that's how I started compiling the data. And it very clearly was showing that if you look at the prevalence of cases among Latinos, we were much more overrepresented. More of us were being infected by the virus relative to our presence across states. Right now, I think that the only state where Latinos are underrepresented with respect to COVID-19 infections is in New Mexico. In all of the other states, Latinos are overrepresented. And then the data were also showing something that was a little bit of a paradox, and that was that Latinos were underrepresented when it came to people dying from COVID. At first glance, it appears that we're doing pretty bad when it comes to becoming infected with the virus, but at the same time, we're less likely to be dying from the virus. And then what I started looking at is the age structure of the Latino population. And for the Latino populations, we're very young. Our median age is about 29 overall in the country. For the white population, it's about 45, 46%. If we look at the elderly, about one out of every five whites is 65 and older. For us in the Latino population, it's one out of every 14 that is 65 and older. So part of that unexpected kind of results that were coming out were really because we're a very young population and we're very much clustered in ages where the probability of dying from COVID as well as overall causes of death in general are relatively low. And whites are much more concentrated in the older age categories. But there's very limited information that allowed you to look at age-specific death rates in the Latino community, as well as infection rates. And very clearly, once you control for age differences, the results were showing very clearly that at each age categories, for example, at age 18 to 49, at age 50 to 64, and at age 65 and older, Latinos were anywhere from 2 to 3 more times or higher more likely to be dying than the white population. So it is very, very clear that in order to interpret the data that are available, that we have to take these age differences into account. Otherwise, we get the impression that Latinos, yes, we're getting infected, but we're not really dying at a very high rate. And that's being hidden by our very young age structure. And another thing that is very important is that, as I mentioned, not only do you have missing information for race as well as for Hispanic and Latino origin, but many states, I would say maybe about a third of the states or even more, they include Latino infections and deaths among the racial categories that they identify with. So Latinos, a high proportion, identify racially as white. So their infections and their deaths are included in the white population so that it includes non-Hispanic whites as well as Hispanics that are white. And then you also have information only for the Latino population. So that it becomes extremely difficult to compare, for example, whites and Latinos, because Latinos are double counted. They're counted among the Latinos, but they're also counted among whites, which tends to suggest that things are worse for whites than they actually are, because about a third or more of the states, Latinos are included with the white population.
Well, you brought up a lot of information that I really want to go back and touch upon. But I want to go back and talk a little bit again about the youthfulness of the Latino population. I mean, here in San Antonio, the majority of those that have been infected are age 40 and below. They're obviously not the majority of the deaths. But it's really interesting to note that, of course, when you hear news about COVID-19, the people who are the most elderly are most at risk, as are those with underlying conditions. But a lot of these young people are probably not keen to the fact that they're carriers of the disease, whether they're symptomatic or not. And so I'm assuming that probably ties in to those high numbers of Latino youth who are being underrepresented in these numbers, correct?
Yeah, I think that the other thing with respect to the high rates of infection that we've seen in the Latino community is that we see in the workforce that Latinos continue to be disproportionately represented, just like African Americans, disproportionately represented among people who are on the front lines, people who are in the essential workforce. So these are individuals that don't have the luxury to stay at home, work from home, and so forth. So they're exposed to the virus and so forth. And we know that there have been particularly individuals with lower levels of education, lower income levels, and so forth, the extent to which they have the proper personal equipment, the PPE, to be able to fight off contracting the virus, places them also in vulnerable kind of situations.
Yeah, and of course, we're hearing about these large numbers of infections within the meatpacking industry. And one thing that's not really mentioned in the stories that we hear about them is most of the employees are more than likely minority, Black or African American, or even immigrant, perhaps even some of them illegal immigrants. So that's just one industry that has the spotlight because it's part of the food chain. There are many other factories out there, I'm sure, that have these same kind of employees, but they're not getting reported and they're not probably getting tested either.
Exactly. And I think agriculture represents one of these occupations as well. I think early on that there was a lot of concern regarding the potential spread in jails, in prisons, in the detention centers, which has been another hotspot for the infections, as well as in meatpacking. But agriculture, we haven't heard that much right now in terms of that situation as well. But these are individuals then that are out there in the front lines. Many of these are people, just like in the Latino community and the African American community, people with pre-existing chronic health conditions and so forth that put them at higher risk. And at the same time, we know that in the Latino community, among the workers 18 to 64, anywhere from 25 to 30% do not have health care insurance. So those are all these little parts of the equation that puts us at an extremely high risk, and that you have these potentials for hotspots, particularly as states, including Texas, have been opening up for business and so forth. Some people think we've gotten out of the brunt of this, but at the same time, as we have more people out there and more businesses opening up and people coming into contact with others and so forth, and perhaps becoming a little bit more relaxed, as the public health experts have pointed out and warned us, that there is a potential for massive second, third waves.
Dr. Rogelio Sainz is a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. When we come back, we continue our conversation with Rogelio Sáenz. And later, the difficulty of contact tracing in border communities.
We have cases that are in El Paso. Some of them have been hospitalized, but that had contact before getting sick with relatives or friends in Juarez.
Stay tuned to Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. If you're Hispanic, you've probably filled out paperwork at your doctor's office and identified your origin as Mexican-American or Latino. That question might be followed by a query on race. More often than not, there's not a category that defines you, so you click Other, if that option is available. If you leave that question blank and if your experience mirrors mine, you're classified as white. Latinos face a similar question when responding to the 2020 census. This classification of Latinos as white is one reason why Dr. Rogelio Sáenz is re-examining the number of COVID-19 infections and fatalities among Latinos in the U.S. Sáenz is a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He examined COVID-19 data dashboards of 38 states. Sáenz says these questions surrounding race result in scattered and incomplete information about Latinos.
And this goes back to the Census Bureau in terms of the Census Bureau asks individuals to identify, one, how they identify as race, white, African American, American Indian, etc., Asian, Pacific Islander, and so forth, as well as other. And then once they've identified as the race, then whether they identify as Latino or Hispanic. And I think that the other situation that takes place, and you mentioned a very good point, that in many situations, there are other people that are identifying us rather than us. And that is particularly the case where if cases are very serious and people are being hospitalized, that we don't have our families with us in the hospital. And if people die, unfortunately, there is not the family member that is able to identify the race or Hispanic origin, Latino origin of the individual. And you may have physicians or nurses or healthcare specialists or coroners or funeral directors, whatever the case may be, that are doing the identification. There is likely to be quite a bit of error in the data as well.
Well, you know, San Antonio has, I think, done a pretty great job of breaking down the demographics of infections, hospitalizations, fatalities, et cetera.
And I know recoveries as well.
Recoveries, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So in all the states in which you have observed, chances are you're not finding the same kind of intricate detail. So what recommendations would you have for some of these states to help better qualify their data to make them more accessible to researchers such as yourself so we can really know what the breakdown is and how this is affecting all populations?
Yeah, again, I focus again on those one-third or more states that aren't separating Latinos from the racial categories that they belong to, because that's extremely important, because the virus is really unveiling the hidden kind of disparities that existed. They're making them bared, the disparities across racial and ethnic groups, but they continue to be veiled and hidden where you have these kinds of reporting that are taking place. And the other situation is with respect to providing data also along the lines of the age breakdown. So we're able to then tease out these kind of differences that exist, particularly in mortality, but also in infection rates, to determine and assess the extent to which you have, again, Latinos and African Americans really disproportionately represented. And the other case here along these lines is with the Native American population. If our data on Latinos are poor, for Native Americans they're even poorer. And we know that there have been, with the Native American population, very high levels of poverty, very high levels of segregation, particularly the individuals that are living on reservations. And at the same time, there is very, very limited information. In New Mexico, the proportion of cases and deaths are extremely high, but that's because they represent a little bit larger population in New Mexico than in other states. And then one other situation is that there are several states across the country that are still not providing any information on race. And there are probably about five or six states around the country that are not providing information on Latinos, including Pennsylvania, which is not providing information on the cases among Latinos. And we know that Pennsylvania is one of these states that has a meatpacking operation where they had experienced a COVID-19 breakout as well. Those data are extremely important in order to make better sense of what is going on. When I did this report about 3 weeks ago, the data that we have now, we have more data than we did then, and I hope that in the coming weeks, we even get more data.
Dr. Rogelio Sainz is a professor of demography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Read a copy of his report, What Do We Know About COVID-19 Infections and Deaths Among Latinos? On TPR.org. Texas has performed almost 1 million COVID-19 tests. Testing is only the start in tracking how the coronavirus has made its way across the Lone Star State. Contact tracing is the next critical step to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Contact tracing may be more difficult on the U.S.-Mexico border, where residents interact binationally with relatives, friends, and coworkers. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports on the challenges of cross-border contact tracing.
We recently received notice that you were tested for COVID-19, and I'd like to ask you a couple questions.
Luis Jauregui is a contact tracer with the El Paso Department of Public Health. These are some of the questions he routinely asks people who've tested positive for COVID-19.
Just to see how you're doing and if we can identify family members or other loved ones around you that we should be keeping an eye on.
To protect medical privacy, we did not listen to an actual phone call, but he demonstrated the process.
Can I get the names of all individuals living with you so that we can place them under monitoring?
Contact tracers work to identify members of the infected person's household and other close contacts who were exposed to the virus and need to self-isolate. The goal? Keep them from spreading COVID-19 to more people.
Thank you so much for your cooperation. But before I let you go,
in this region, bilingual contact tracers are critical.
Wonderful. Let me just verify your date of birth and address real quick.
People not only switch back and forth between English and Spanish, they also go back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border. Though closed to all but essential travel to contain the virus, a significant number of U.S. citizens and legal residents cross over to visit relatives and do essential jobs in both countries.
This morning, I contacted the health authorities in Juarez.
Fernando Gonzalez, the lead epidemiologist for El Paso's health department, is in touch with his counterparts in Juarez on a regular basis.
We have cases. There are in El Paso. Some of them have been hospitalized, but that had contact before getting sick with relatives or friends in Juarez.
The health departments in the sister cities have long collaborated to prevent and contain a range of infectious diseases on the border. The pandemic is creating new pressure, says infectious disease expert Ogachika Alozi. He's also chief medical officer at Del Sol Medical Center in El Paso.
And I understand that historically we've had great relationships with the public health department there. I think that in the trying times of a pandemic, it tests the strength of those relationships very quickly.
Each border city has to contend with layers of local, state, and federal governments and different schedules for restarting economic activities. As Texas reopens more businesses, drive-through testing is now ramping up in El Paso. Mexico is testing at a much lower rate, and in Juarez has so far mostly been limited to hospitals and health clinics. The lag time between identifying a positive case and contact tracing can have serious consequences, says Alozi.
that's probably a positive that was infected 2 weeks ago. When we see people showing up in our emergency room, that's probably 4 weeks ago. And when we unfortunately do have deaths, that was probably 6 to 8 weeks ago. And so we're always behind the eight ball in terms of the data we have and how we respond to it.
In Juarez, global health expert Dr. Alejandro Diaz-Villalobos shares that concern.
Oh my God, Angela, that's one of the stepping stones of this. You know, we need to trace contacts.
Diaz is especially worried about having adequate protocols in place before maquiladoras, multinational manufacturing plants, reopen in Juarez June 1st.
The more information and reliable information we have, the better the outcome. So that's basically the challenge, information. We need to know who, where, and how. Everything.
Right now, testing is so low in Juarez, contact tracers follow up with what health officials refer to as suspected COVID-19 cases. Back in El Paso, epidemiologist Gonzalez has identified an individual who tested positive and has a large number of contacts in Juarez as well.
Today, one of the binational was 10 contacts.
Contact tracers will warn those people they're all at risk of having been infected with COVID-19 and could be spreading the coronavirus themselves to others on both sides of the border. In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Ben Henry is our podcast producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.